Welcome to Chic Perspectives. I'm Elizabeth Gordon, and we are talking business strategy today. Here on the Chic Perspectives show, I have an awesome guest for you. Rich Horwath is with us, and we are going to get into some real good strategic conversations about what business leaders need to be thinking about right now to move ahead in their business. Rich is the founder and president of the Strategic Thinking Institute, helping managers develop competitive advantage for their business. He's a former chief strategy officer and currently serves as professor of strategy at the Lake Forest Graduate School of Management. So he is definitely the right person for us to talk to today and get all the insight. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Elizabeth, great to be with you today.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, Rich's new book, Deep Dive, The Proven Method for Building Strategy, Focusing Your Resources, and Taking Smart Action. Tell me what inspired this book, because you're actually the author of four other business books as well.
Yeah, Elizabeth, you know, I was scuba diving in Cozumel, Mexico about 7 years ago, and not very strategic of me. I actually ran out of oxygen about 100 feet below the surface of the water. So that incident actually made me realize in that moment how important that one resource of oxygen really was. And as I thought about that later in doing work with Fortune 500 companies around the world, I realized that especially in mid-size to large organizations, we often don't place very much value on our resources, our time, our talent, and our budgets. I mean, we talk about that, but we don't really think of them like a scuba diver would think of oxygen. And the more valuable and the more value that we place on resources, the more effective we're going to be by being able to focus those resources in the right areas. So that was really the inspiration for the book.
Well, and I love the analogy and the story because it's so true that people don't pay attention to just what is all around. They take for granted the resources that they have access to until suddenly there's a crunch and all of a sudden we realize just how important those resources are to us. And it does seem like the larger an organization gets, the more they lose sight of those resources. So what can companies do to make good decisions from a strategic standpoint about how they are using their resources?
You know, Elizabeth, I think the first thing to do is get everybody on that proverbial same page as to what strategy is, what are goals, what are objectives, what are tactics. You know, we've heard these business planning terms thrown around forever. And most people would say, yeah, sure, we understand, we know that. But I was just doing work with a $40 billion company on the East Coast this past week. And even at the senior level, those simple terms, goals, objectives, strategies, and tactics, were misused and miscommunicated throughout the organization. So I think the number one thing companies can do is make sure that everybody in your organization is speaking the same language when it comes to the key planning terms that are really going to drive your marketing plans, your business development plans, your strategic plans. I think that's the first thing. And then the second thing is really get people to understand what are the trade-offs that we're going to make with our resources. You know, Elizabeth, I know from your work, you know, you talk a lot about the importance of focus and, you know, identifying, you know, who is your customer and picking those folks out. And I think that's really important today more than ever. The companies that have tried to be all things to all people, kind of the United Airlines, the Kmarts of the world, have basically gone bankrupt because they haven't really found who their key customer is and what the value is they can provide to those folks. So I think when it comes to resource allocation in companies, number one, people have to understand the key planning terms, and number two, they have to be very clear about where are we going to focus our limited resources, our time, our people, and our budget.
Right, and I like how you talk about in the book that, you know, strategic planning has become this activity and this elongated process that these big companies engage in. However, they do it somehow without having a clear strategy.
Yeah, that's exactly it, Elizabeth. You know, in a lot of companies, what passes for strategic planning is basically a review of last year's budget and last year's tactics, and then a few tweaks to those, and then we use that for our plan next year. And when you substitute numbers for strategy, it's like a person saying, well, I want to be a multimillionaire by the time I'm 40. Well, that's great, but you haven't told us anything about how you're going to do that, and that's what strategy is. So you can have your financial goals, and those are going to be important for the company. But what most companies don't do is they don't lay out very clearly what is the path or the strategies that are going to take us to that spot. And, you know, it's funny because especially as you talked about, Elizabeth, in large organizations, strategic planning is this humongous effort that takes 2 or 3 months, thousands of PowerPoint slides. And to me, that would be like buying a new car this past year and then going back to the dealer 1 year later and saying, can you rebuild this car from scratch for me? You know, that's how we tend to create strategy. And I think, you know, we waste a lot of time and we lose a lot of our good morale and momentum by spending that much time doing something that should be done on a regular basis.
I agree. And I think that, you know, now companies are seeing that, hey, you know, we don't have time to waste here. The clock is ticking and we don't have time to think about this in this kind of bloated type of a sense. It needs to be real crystal clear. One of the things that you talk about in the book is the competitive advantage as strategy's holy grail. Talk a little bit about this, the capabilities, activities, and offerings. And if you have examples for some of the companies that you've worked with, I'd love to hear how this has sort of played out.
Sure. You know, and it's a question I pose a lot of times when I'm speaking to organizations or to associations is, you know, how do you define competitive advantage? And could the people that work for you define competitive advantage, and would they do it the same way? And the answer generally is no. You know, we all know that competitive advantage is important in business, especially in for-profit organizations, because the reality is the statistics are showing that, you know, 50% of companies that go bankrupt don't have strategy and competitive advantage. So the reality is if you don't have a good strategic plan and competitive advantage today, you may not actually have a business or a job tomorrow. So it's more important than ever. And what I try and do is you know, with most of the strategy concepts, competitive advantage being one example, is really break it down into its simplest application. And really there's three building blocks when it comes to competitive advantage. The first is your capabilities. And the capabilities really are comprised of your resources, your assets. So things like your technology, intellectual property, any patents that you have, your people, those things are your capabilities. And I think if you jot down what your capabilities are, say on the top third of a piece of paper, that gives you a start to understand what are the things that are kind of we're building from. And then from there, the second component of competitive advantage is activities. And activities are the things that we do to transform our assets or our resources into offerings. So it might be things like marketing, sales, manufacturing, business development, internet work, those types of things. And then the third piece is really our offerings. So what are the products or services that actually get offered up to customers at some point? So, you know, I think, again, if people can think of competitive advantage as your capabilities, your people, your intellectual property, your resources, then your activities, what are you doing with those, and then how do those create your offerings that add differentiated value to your customer? And so, you know, one example I would give to you is if you look at Enterprise Rent-A-Car. You know, Enterprise Rent-A-Car is now the number one car rental agency in North America, and they surpassed Hertz in revenue because they developed competitive advantage. And when you look at how they've done that, you can look at their capabilities. And their capabilities consist of things like hiring people right out of undergrad as opposed to experienced managers so they can train them right. They've got a proprietary technology that helps them with customer service and doing customer calls right after visits so that they have a really good pulse on who's doing customer service well. Then you look at their activities, and their activities are things like a customer satisfaction survey that's given out automatically 10 minutes after a customer leaves the office via email so that they can understand what's happening there. And then when you look at their offerings, really what you found is that they've been able to place their locations not primarily in airports, but more in communities, and they've been able to embed themselves in communities, and that's really given them a lock on a lot of the markets. And now Hertz is trying to play catch-up in Avis and Budget, but Enterprise has really become number one because they've been able to develop competitive advantage by creating capabilities, activities, and then offerings.
That's a great example, because I think a lot of people would say, oh, that was a real crowded marketplace to go into. How are you going to create competitive advantage? You know, people are already renting cars. What else can you do? And it's so good to see that using this model, I think people can figure out ways that they can compete with the big players that are already out there. They can tweak the strategy. They can do something a little bit different and provide a lot more value to a customer, or different value to a customer, and thereby generate a competitive advantage. So you don't have to be the first one with the idea.
Elizabeth, you hit on something that's so important, I think, there. You know, we hear all the time that, well, it's a competitive market and we're not first in, and, you know, we do the same thing as everybody else, and, well, you know, it's just kind of up in the air. And I think, you know, people have to take some accountability today. There's a lot of examples, Enterprise being one, and there's many others, where companies that have been in competitive markets that are fairly mature have found ways to win. And I think the one question that I always come back to when we look at a company is, what's the differentiated value you provide to customers? If you can answer that question, then now you've got something that you can build on. If you can, and vice versa, if you can't answer that question, that's a red flag to say, you know what, we are becoming a commodity because we don't provide value that's different than the competition. And at the end of the day, that's what customers want.
And some the companies that have been weak in that area, it's now being exposed. I mean, a lot of CEOs are saying, oh, it's the weak economy, that's why, you know, our performance is down, our profits are down. How much of a business's performance do you think is dependent on the economy as a whole?
You know, it's funny. I've wanted to research that question, and I did research it. And what I found out was that looking at the about 500 companies over the last 10 years, only 4%. So only 4% of a company's financial performance can be attributed to the economy overall. So what the study shows was that about 70% is due to the company's strategy, and then another 13 or 14% were also due to other internal factors. So when we hear CEOs in the news talking about, well, because of the poor economy, we're doing poorly, I don't buy that at all, and I think it's a cop-out. And if I have money in a company and I hear a CEO say that, I'm pulling my money from that company and my stock, because what you're telling me then is you only have control over your company in good times, and the reality is not all times are going to be good. I want to hear from leaders that say, even in the difficult times, here's what we're doing to create that differentiated value, and here's how we're outperforming our competition. That's what people want to hear. People don't want to hear excuses, and we see that in the news time and time again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's easy, and everybody likes to jump on that bandwagon and suddenly say, oh, it's not our fault. You know, we're doing the best we can. But it sounds like, from a strategic standpoint, taking some of these measures is how a company can that the odds aren't even that the economy will affect you. It's really all in your hands as the company leader.
Absolutely. You know, you look at a company like Apple or Google or Panera Bread or Cirque du Soleil. They have been making money hand over fist in 2009. So, you know, when people say, oh, it's a recession. Yeah, go tell that to Google and go tell that to Steve Jobs at Apple. But, you know, they would laugh at you, because the reality is, if you've got products and services that people find differentiated value in, you are making money in good times and bad times. And I think what's happened is, over the last year and a half with the recession, what the recession has done is it has exposed the companies that don't have a plan, that don't have a way to separate themselves from the competition. That's all it's done. And so if you've got a solid plan, if you've been working that plan the last couple of years, then you should not be in huge financial trouble today. And if you are, we've got to go back and say, what's your competitive advantage? And again, you can use that model that you brought up earlier, capabilities, activities, and offerings, to see where you're at.
So what do you think about the automakers, Rich?
Yeah, you know, when you look at the automakers, it's interesting. You know, we saw the numbers come out a couple weeks ago, and Ford, which was the only U.S. automaker that didn't take bailout money from the government, is actually very profitable now, and their sales are up, and they're doing very well. And I think, you know, the bottom line is, when we have government working in the capital markets, and when they're in a free market situation, they don't fare well. I mean, you look at all their track records and a lot of different things, and the reality is, you know, government hasn't been able to compete for whatever reason when it comes to the free market. And so, you know, again, I think the automakers are a good lesson for all of your listeners, Elizabeth, in that if you're providing different value, and look at a company, look at a car like the Mini Cooper. You know, the Mini Cooper is that cute little car, and we recognize it when we see it on the road. And, you know, you look at that versus, you know, the GM cars, the Chrysler cars, and the reality is GM and Chrysler, they've got a lot of cars that kind of blend in with one another and blend in with the competition, whereas a car like the Mini Cooper, boom, it stands out because it's different. Not everybody's going to find value in it, but again, to your point, what you write a lot about, Elizabeth, they have focused on a specific customer segment that does find value, and they've been very, very successful. So I think it's a good lesson for all of us that, you know, just doing the same things in the same ways year after year after year and being complacent and fat and happy is going to catch up with you at some point.
Yeah, I think you got to dare to be different. You can't just be a me too anymore. And you even in the book compare the success of the Mini Cooper to Johnny Cash. What do you think they have in common?
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up. You know, when you look at Johnny Cash, you listen to his recordings back from the 50s, 60s, 70s, heck, even 80s and 90s. You know, he never had the best singing voice. And I think, but the reality was, he's always been very successful, not because he was trying to be the best, but because he was different. And again, I think if we move from this idea of being better, you know, always wanting to be better, to how are we different? You know, we can ask, you know, is blueberry pie better than banana cream? Well, that's going to really depend on whom you ask. However, you can say blueberry pie is different because it has blueberries, which contain antioxidants, which are good for you and may help you live longer. So I think, you know, the news flash is there is no better. We need to stop thinking about are we better, and we need to think about how are we different. And when we do that, it starts to lead us down paths that will actually provide tangible value to customers, and that's really what we should be striving to do.
Now, we talked a little bit about the government, and it sounds like you don't think they're in a good position to strategically run the country at this time. What do you think about, you know, the state of our government and their involvement in business, and what we can sort of learn from, you know, what business is good at, what the government's good at, who should stick to what?
Yeah, you know, I would, you know, if I had a chance to sit down with President Obama, and I don't have that invitation as of today, so if you have that connection, Elizabeth, I'd be happy to hear
that. I'll see if I can hook you up, Rich.
Exactly. But if I did, you know, I would tell him what I tell a lot of folks in business, a lot of the CEOs that I work with, and that is you've got a number one focus. And, you know, we talked about that earlier today, but the reality is when you're working on trying to overhaul education, you're trying to overhaul healthcare, immigration, energy policy. We're trying to juggle too many balls at once. And when you do that, obviously they start to fall. And so we need to have a much greater focus. And after that, the second piece is we need to simplify. You know, when President Obama was campaigning to be elected, he kept his messaging very simple. You know, we're going to change and change and change, and that resonated with people.
Right, that's what works.
Exactly. But now that he's in office, I don't know if it's because of, you know, you've got Congress, drafting a lot of the healthcare reform, you've got a lot of his handlers, you know, sending out different messages, But things have become much more complex. You know, when you present a 1,000 plus page healthcare plan reform, that doesn't resonate with people. You know, I understand there's complexities in there, but you've got to boil it down and communicate the essence. And I think they've completely missed the boat on doing that. And now I think they find themselves in a very reactive state. So, you know, I would say that would be the one thing. The other big thing from a government perspective is not seeing the big picture. You know, a perfect example of that was this past summer, the government came out with the program called Cash for Clunkers.
And oh,
the Cash
yeah.
Do you remember that?
They're still talking about it,
Yeah, so, you know, the Cash for Clunkers was basically, you know, it reminded me of Paris Hilton. You know, you look at it at first and it seems okay, and then a couple minutes later you're saying, is that it? You know, where else is the value here? And so,
right, it was a Band-Aid move, a temporary patch, and now it's actually even muddled the retail numbers because now they're saying, well, we can't really measure what's going on in our economy because we gave up that dumb Cash for Clunkers program, so now we have bad data. So it was very short-sighted, I think.
That, Elizabeth, you're exactly right. It was very short-sighted. So I think, the take-home for most of us is, you know, in looking at what, you know, some of the missteps by the government is we've got to focus and we've got to continually see the big picture and not, you know, like you said, not look for Band-Aids on symptoms, but really get to the root of what's causing our issues.
Well, and this brings me to the power of no, which is one of the main points in your book. Now, what exactly does this mean for managers as far as taking control of this power of no?
Well, you know, Elizabeth, and again, I go back to a lot of what you've written because I like your stuff. You know, it comes down to where are we focusing? You know, we all have a limited number of hours and a limited number of days that we work. We've got a limited number of dollars from a budget perspective, and yet we tend to spread those things evenly across lots of little things that at the end of the day, at the end of the year, when if we really sit down and look hard at it, don't add a lot of value. And I think, again, the companies and the leaders that are most successful have shown that if you have an extreme focus in one or two areas, you're going to be much, much more successful. And I think from a manager perspective, one of the things I'd recommend to folks is, you know, we all have our to-do lists, right? You know, it's on our computer, it's on our iPhone. We've got a number of things that are on the to-do list. Come up with a not-to-do list. What are the things specifically that you and your team are not going to do? Where are you not going to spend your time? Which types of customers are you not going to call on because they're not profitable and maybe they take up too much customer service time? So the more specific we can be with what we're not going to do, that really frees up more resources to do other things. And, you know, today we all want to be yes people. We all want to be team players. But the reality is, there's a lot of team players that are looking for work. The people that are focused and disciplined with how they use their resources are the ones that are really going to be most successful.
And that's a good point. I mean, this is advice that's just as valid whether you're gainfully employed right now or not. What do you think is the most important factor in finding a job or in getting a promotion in the work world right now? Because with all of what's going on, how does somebody pull ahead and really differentiate themselves in their career?
Yeah, you know, I think it comes down to three things. And I think number one is you've got to understand what's your passion, performance, intersection. So passion, what do you love to do? There's so many people out there that hate their jobs and that are not engaged at work, and we spend way too much time working to not enjoy what you're doing. So I think that, you know, I first pull out a piece of paper, write down on the left side, what are the things you love to do? Put those down. Personal time, work time, what do you love to do? On the right side of the paper, then, what are you good at? In the past, where have you shown to be strong, to add value? And put those things on the right side. And then start playing with those kind of back and forth, the things you're good at, the things you like to do. And, you know, so an example might be, you know, say you enjoy having friends over and entertaining for dinner because you'll like to cook, and maybe you're good at setting and achieving your goals. Well, maybe, you know, a potential job opportunity would be to be in business development or marketing for a restaurant chain or a catering service where you're in contact with the food, and then you still have a very much a business focus. So I think that's number one. What do you love to do and what are you good at? Find that out. Number two is, what's the value you bring to an organization? You know, we all like to say, well, I have 15 or 20 years of experience. There's a thousand, there's thousands of resumes that lead with 15, 20 years of experience today. We've got to be much more specific and say, what's the tangible, touchable value I can bring to your organization? So it's not good enough to say I have 15 years of experience marketing. What's better is to say, you know, I've done these three marketing projects where I worked with social networking sites in order to drive consumer traffic through our website that resulted in X thousands of dollars in sales. Now, if I'm a company that's potentially going to hire you, boom, I get what you're doing and I get the value you can bring. And then the last piece I would say is develop a relationship map. You know, when we're looking for work, too often we just think about one or two people that we know, and or somebody says, hey, have you talked to this person? We need to develop a map. Write down on paper, visually, all the folks that you know, all the companies they work for. Then methodically start contacting those people, letting them know what you're looking for, and asking if they have any people they know that might be of value in your search. Then add those people to your relationship map as well. And once you do that and start methodically working through it, then all of a sudden I think you've got a really good baseline to build your job search on.
That's great advice. I like to ask all my guests here on the Chic Perspectives show to provide a chic tip, Rich, for women or men who are looking to really differentiate themselves in their business or their career. What's your chic tip for our listeners today?
Yeah, you know, I've thought about that. And when you consider, again, strategy and strategic thinking, my chic tip is new growth comes from new thinking. New growth comes from new thinking, whether it's in your personal life or your professional life. If you want things to change for the better, you have to give yourself new ways to think about your life or your business. That can come from people you talk to. It can come from reading books or magazine articles. It can come from new questions or new frameworks or new models to look at. But again, I think new growth comes from new thinking. The people who get frustrated are the ones that are doing the same thing in the same way year after year after year and are not able to get out of that rut.
Great one. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure having you on today. Again, everybody, Rich Horwath, the author of the new book, Deep Dive, The Proven Method for Building Strategy, Focusing Your Resources, and Taking Smart Action. Where can everybody find the book, Rich?
Elizabeth, the book is available anywhere books are sold. So Barnes & Noble, Borders, Amazon.com, if you're in the airport, Hudson's as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much. I learned a lot, and I'm sure all of our listeners did as well. So I appreciate you coming on today and sharing all of your strategic thinking with us.
Absolutely, Elizabeth. I'm a big fan of your work as well, and I really appreciated the chance to chat with you today.
Excellent. All right, everybody, we're out of time for today. This is Elizabeth Gordon signing off from the Chic Perspective Show. Check out more Chic Perspectives interviews at chicentrepreneur.com. Until next time, wishing you chic success.